Our speaker, John Rennie, is only the seventh editor-in-chief in the 162-year history of Scientific American magazine. Since his appointment in late 1994, he has been the creative force behind the modernization and reinvigoration of this great publishing institution. For several years, Mr. Rennie also worked by night as a sketch and improvisational comedian in New York, Boston, and college venues. These days, his major hobby is the study of karate, in which he holds the rank of Yandan, which is a fourth-degree black belt. So it's my great pleasure to introduce a skeptic who literally kicks ass, John Rennie.
Thank you. Oh, that's very nice of you. I have to say, first of all, I was delighted enough that I would actually be invited to help kick off this lecture series and to know that the New York City Skeptics Association was getting started. I mean, I think the fact that we didn't have one before sort of astonished me. I think I'd taken it for granted that, of course, we have a nice organized group of skeptics out there, but it's really great to be here at the inauguration of that. And I really want to thank all of you for braving rain and scaffolding and protests and whatever other sorts of things might have stood in your way in getting you here. So it's really great. So as you may have heard, I'm talking today about Scientific American, A Century and a Half of Skepticism. Even that's slightly undervaluing it. Scientific American has been around since August 28th of 1845. Back at that point, it looked kind of like this. It was just 4 pages long, 4 big newspaper-like pages. It had lots of patent announcements, and it had poetry, and it had little reports on science, and all kinds of things about that. And these days, it actually looks, more like this, and has a picture of me in it, which means it's not actually gotten any better during that time. So it's all sort of neutralized itself. Having been around since 1845, this is a very long time, obviously. This is around since basically about the beginning of the Second Industrial Revolution. This is before the Civil War. This is so early that we know that Thomas Edison read it as a boy. And we know Thomas Edison read it as a boy because he came to the offices of the editors and told them when he was demonstrating his invention of the phonograph for the first time. Having been around since 1845, I mean, Scientific American has been around since before airplanes, since before automobiles, since before x-rays, since before relativity, obviously. It has been around since the discovery of the electron. It has been around since before the germ theory of disease. It has been around for a very long time. What it has not been around longer than is stupidity. And that is something that at some level the editors and writers for Scientific American have always dealt with during that very long history. And so I'm going to try to show you just a few highlights or lowlights, as the case may be, of some of Scientific American's experience with that, maybe particularly weighted towards some of my own experience of that more recently. I think some of it will be sort of fun and instructive for you. As I say, we've been around for a long time, but for me, really, the golden era of Scientific American's involvement with anything like skepticism was really back in the late teens, 1920s, because during this time, Scientific American was involved with several different projects that were aimed at trying to debunk various things that were of questionable scientific accuracy. One of them had to do with the whole area of, it looked very critically at different areas of medical quackery. And to that end, this is maybe the one that they were probably most famous for. How many of you have ever heard of the electronic reactions of Abrams? Not too many, probably. It's these days, it's not very well known. Take my word for it, however, that At the time, in the early 1920s, this was one of the major health fads sweeping the United States. It was founded by this fellow, Dr. Albert Abrams, who came up with this, this radiological approach to diagnosis and ultimately treatment for disease. And it was so compelling, it was so attractive to a lot of the United States that that it actually started to win over different practitioners, and the AMA started to see it as a major threat. And they were mounting their own efforts to try to defeat the spread of the ERA. And Scientific American was pulled in to try to help debunk this as well. And so Scientific American, well, we'll get to what Scientific American did. Let's start by just talking about the ERA itself. The ERA process, Dr. Abrams seems to have hit about something around 1916 or so. He seems to have had this idea for approaching diagnosis that involved a device that he called the dynamizer. And if you look at it, the dynamizer is this box here, and what you're looking at is a diagnostic procedure going on. Now, I think it's safe to say that most of you looking at this picture would imagine that this person is the patient, and this is the doctor / ERA practitioner. No. And I'm not going to then try to tell you that this is actually the patient, because that would just be weird. No, the patient is not actually in this picture, because this is the magic of how the ERA actually worked. With the ERA, the patient would give like a blood sample, or it could be a sample of pretty much anything. Indeed, over time it started to become something so liberal that it went from just blood or other body fluids to the point where Abrams was saying that you could take handwriting or just pictures of people, and that would be taken and would be inserted into the dynamizer. And the dynamizer, then the wires from the dynamizer would then reach up and be attached to a healthy person who would have to orient themselves facing west, because that was very important, and they would hold these things here and they would attach the other leads as necessary, and then the practitioner would come up and would palpate this control person's belly and listen, and from the sounds he could determine what was wrong with the person who had given the blood sample. Because, you see, and this is going to be scientific, so some of you may want to, if you ask me to repeat this, I will, because it's very complicated. The electronic resonances associated with the diseased atoms would migrate up through the wires and would alter the electronic resonances of this person. And so the practitioner could then listen to this and could determine it. Now, why it was he didn't just go and listen to the diseased person, I actually don't know. Even now, it's not really clear. But this was great, because Abrams would sell these boxes for like $400 to people who he were licensed to become new ERA practitioners. And the great thing was that part of the license was you were not for any reason allowed to open up the box and look inside. Never could you look inside the box. So, you know, they were selling this, and he was also then selling different sorts of seminars, teaching people how to use the devices. He was minting money. He made, I'm not sure of this now. I want to say he might have actually brought in something like $16 million, which I may have the number wrong, but you can imagine it was certainly millions of dollars in the early 1920s, which was an appreciable sum of money. So, and this, by the way, he didn't just stop at diagnosis. He also moved on to the area of treatment, because, of course, if you can use these resonances to diagnose what's wrong by reversing the polarity using a device called the oscilloclast, which is kind of an inverted dynamizer. Again, I can say this more slowly if it's more too complicated. He could then actually correct the resonances and fix whatever was wrong with you. And it was great. I mean, after a while, he was just fixing pretty much anything with this. And he was even being used to, at some point, identify where people might be. I mean, Abrams at one point didn't stop short of actually taking a photograph of someone and using his dynamizer to look at a map and figure out where that person might be. Can you imagine why the health authorities thought this might actually be worth stopping? So Scientific American stepped into this, and they undertook a nine-month investigation of the ERA in which they painstakingly, laboriously looked at all the claims for it and treated it exactly the way. It was a model of investigation because they basically said, all right, Abrams would not cooperate with this. Abrams wanted nothing to do with it, but Scientific American found one practitioner who was willing to cooperate. Dr. X, as he's referred to in the magazine at the time. And Dr. X would consent to this, and so Dr. X would say, this is how ERA works, this is what you're supposed to do, and the panel that Scientific American put together would then say, all right, if that's the case, well, let's try this. So they started them with this great test in which they gave the ERA practitioner, Dr. X, they gave him a series of pure germ cultures in test tubes, and basically said, so here it is, this is the purified causative agent of these. It's unlabeled, just tell us what this is. Because if you can certainly diagnose that someone has, say, syphilis in their bodies from this process, from a blood sample, then if we give you pure germ culture, you should certainly be able to identify it that way. And Dr. X agreed that this was a good test, and he then applied that. And the results were actually amazing, because the results were that he didn't get any of them right. He got all of them wrong. In fact, it was beyond what you would have imagined, that just random chance you would have thought he would have gotten some of them right. Well, Dr. X did not take this lying down, because he looked at it and said, oh, well, here's the problem. You see, the labels that you've written this, some of them have red ink. Well, the redness of the label is interfering with the resonance. So they changed that, and they kept doing this, and they kept doing this over and over again, month after month. Every time they would test it and ERA would fail, then there was always some sort of excuse. And they would correct for this, and they would go back and do it again and again. And they eventually got to the point where they did somehow find a dynamizer, and they just tore it open and looked inside. And they determined that the dynamizer inside was, as you would probably have imagined, a complete rat's nest of just wires that in some cases weren't connected to anything. It looked complicated if you even did peek inside. Some of them didn't even connect to the external leads on this thing. So after 9 months, Scientific American finally came to its own conclusion on all of this, and their verdict, and this was part of a much longer article denouncing all of this, but as you can see, it basically said, this committee finds that the claims advanced on behalf of the electronic reactions of Abrams and of electronic practice in general are not substantiated, and it is our belief that they have no basis. In fact, in our opinion, the so-called electronic reactions do not occur, and the so-called electronic treatments are without value. It was a model example of the kind of thing that I think we would all like to see when it's possible to try to take some sorts of medical quackery and subject it to good skeptical scrutiny all the way through. Scientific American was not always so successful in this regard. Because around the same time, another series of things that it was involved with was in looking at the spiritualism movement. Spiritualism, very, very big at the time. Lots of seances were going on. And Scientific American undertook a competition in which they were promising two $2,500 prizes to any medium, any spiritual medium, who could demonstrate certain things, being able to demonstrate a physical manifestation to the satisfaction of the investigating board, or could otherwise, just show other sorts of proofs of this. And they went through for months after months, really years, looking at different mediums and just, you know, blowing them up. Harry Houdini was part of the team that would travel around with Scientific American. I don't believe that I don't believe that Arthur Conan Doyle was actually part of this, because, of course, he was a little soft on the subject of spiritualism. But he was involved with this a lot as well. And there was one editor, Malcolm C. Byrd, who was the wonderfully named Malcolm C. Byrd, who was the managing editor of Scientific American at the time. And it's pretty clear when you read back through the accounts that they wrote of their attempts to bust these different seances, that Byrd was kind of sympathetic to the spiritualist cause. It was pretty clear that he actually, in a lot of cases, really wanted to find a ghost in some of these. However, the board that they put together, the panel they would send to these seances, they found what they found. They kept finding fraud after fraud. This all came to a head, however, when eventually came to look at the case of a famous spirit medium whose name was Mina Crandon, and her name was actually left out of the accounts itself, but she was generally referred to as Marjorie, and this became sort of the downfall of Scientific American's ghost-busting crusade. Because Marjorie was, she would have these various meetings in which she would just seemingly just would show amazing things and prove that she just had amazing contact with the spirit world, often through the medium of Walter. Walter, who was the male voice who would speak through her at these times. And people were really quite impressed with the job that she was doing. And apparently, now this is something I'm getting directly from Penn Jillette himself, because when I was telling this story back at the Amazing Meeting last year, Penn Jillette was actually able to elaborate on this, because he had met and had interviewed the granddaughter of Mina Crandon. And the granddaughter was able to confirm certain things. Mina was kind of a looker, particularly by the times, and apparently she would do a lot of her seances in the nude. This may have sort of softened some of the skepticism that was associated with this, and that may, in fact, have actually affected when Scientific American's investigative team showed up and actually started living in the Crandon's house in Boston. As you can see, that's Dr. Walter Pierce, who's a member of the board. That's Malcolm Byrd, who is really there's no other thing to say except that he's perched on the shoulder of Mina, and yes, Harry Houdini standing there as well. And again, I mean, it's clear as you are reading this that Malcolm Byrd is just transfixed with Mina. He just thinks she's great. When you read those accounts, he is strongly believing that he has finally found the genuine article. And again, I can only cite what Penn Jillette told me about this, that apparently, according to Marjorie's granddaughter, yes, she really was sleeping with all of them. which was convenient. Not for Scientific American, however, because Scientific American was well on its way toward forking over those $5,000 in prize money. But then, and it was prepared to do this while Harry Houdini, who was properly part of the team, was not there. He was off on tour. And he heard about the fact, he was reading that it looked like Scientific American was closing in on doing this, and he rushed back so he could be there for another seance that involved all of them. And in he's there for the seance, he was very upset that Malcolm Byrd and the other members of the panel seemed ready to award this, and in the middle of the seance, at one point, Harry Houdini leaps to his feet and points to some evidence of fakery and is denouncing her right in the middle of it. And Malcolm Byrd leaps to his feet and starts to vigorously defend Mina's honor, which led to what I get the impression was then a fist fight of some sort that broke out between Harry Houdini and Malcolm Byrd. And I think it is probably an excess of my own imagination that imagines this spilling out into the street somehow. Because I really can't imagine that in a fist fight between Harry Houdini and Malcolm Bird that it would last very long. However, it was enough to pretty much destroy the ghost-busting attempts of Scientific American at that point. So it never actually gave out the $5,000 in prizes. Yay. But still, it was not a great spot for Scientific American's efforts to try to be a good critical practitioner on this. Let's zip forward a few decades to dealing with some of the sorts of things that are more a more modern bane on our existence. And, of course, here we get to creationism, which, you know, creationism still amazingly with us and has been for quite some time. And it takes its various different forms. Gosh, how'd that get in there? Now, creationism, you know, as I think you all know, creationism is fundamentally a supernatural explanation for how life arose. There's really no way of getting around it because you're trying to posit the existence of some sort of entity, whether it's a supernatural entity or not. You're trying to posit one that we do not know exists and that would have done something that we cannot imagine how it could have achieved these ends. Typically, we do think about religious creationism, the sort of, you know, biblical fundamentalism. But I think it's important, and it would be easy for me to kick at the same old targets that we're all used to about that Noah's Ark and Genesis and all the rest of that. Let me show you something a little bit different, because it is probably worth noting that creationism, religious creationism, trying to pass itself off as a form of scientific explanation, is really not in any way restricted to the Christian fundamentalist world. You might have heard about this. Look at this. This is the Atlas of Creation. This is a book that you may have heard of because thousands, if not tens of thousands of copies of this book have been sent to various schools and other influential places around the world from a group in Turkey, an Islamic group in Turkey that has pushed this. And the Atlas of Creation is a gigantic would-be refutation to the claims of scientific, of evolution. In particular, it is ostensibly written by Harun Yahya, who mentions that this is a pen name that he actually uses. However, it is generally assumed that Harun Yahya is actually a pseudonym used by a group with a lot of money that is putting these things out. Speaking as somebody in the publishing world, and I see actually we have Bob Worth from the book publishing world, I think you can attest that this book, which is about 800 pages long and is lavishly, richly produced with beautiful, beautiful four-color photographs on every page, this is an extremely expensive book. This volume would cost hundreds of dollars, I think it is safe to say, and there are thousands of these being sent out around the world. How many of them are being sent out? Our office received, I think, four of them. More of them, really? Okay. So, and what is it? Well, and I am not exaggerating about this. In fact, I'm happy to pass this around. You should all try to take a look at this if you can. I mean, it is a fantastically, richly made book. And it is hundreds and hundreds of pages that consist of things like this. It will have a photograph of various fossil ferns, and then living ferns, and then a few words of explanation that say, all the characteristics of ferns today were also shared by ferns that lived millions of years ago. Fossil records clearly reveal this. I've chosen one page that didn't actually make the point that I wanted to say. Yes, all right, perfect. Here's one similar sort of thing. The moon-eye fish. Fossil fish, living fish. The moon-eye fish is a medium-sized North American fish, blah, blah, blah. The fact that a 50-million-year-old moon-eye fish is identical to its living descendants cannot be explained by evolutionists. Now, if you know anything at all about evolution, you know, yeah, it can. It doesn't This is a very ancient variation on a stupid argument sometimes referred to the, if we evolved from monkeys, why are there still monkeys? An argument that, by the way, some people will say is so stupid no one actually makes it. Well, someone does make it at tremendous expense for more than 750 pages. I mean, it's amazing. It's that same argument page after page. That is all this book does. It looks at various fossils and shows you that they look just like living things, and therefore evolution must be wrong. Take a look at this. Imagine what's involved in that. So that is still just a, it's just worth noting that that is a shows just how vigorous religious creationism is, even outside the Christian world. But really, these days, what we more often have to be concerned with, certainly in the United States, because we at least have principles of separation of church and state are supposed to apply, is, of course, intelligent design creationism. This is creationism that really pretends to be a science. And I think most of you are probably pretty well familiar with most of this, so I'm not going to spend a lot of time. I mean, I think you're familiar with the ideas of specified complexity that William Dembski talks about, philosopher and mathematician, making the point that some things are just too complicated to have ever evolved, or that they are too complicated in a special way. And he has this sort of explanatory filter in which he basically tries to divide the world up between things that are designed and things that happen by chance. And that, you know, therefore, if an airplane couldn't have just fallen together by chance, it must have been designed. And therefore, the same thing must be true of a Tyrannosaurus. And that's pretty much the entire works of William Dembski in roughly 30 words. Then we have Michael Behe makes this argument about irreducible complexity. This is an argument in which he says that if you look at the features of living things, that they often are complicated in a way such that they couldn't have evolved, because unless all of the components were all there at once, they wouldn't have worked. And so he makes this example constantly and talks about that's a bacterium. Some bacteria make their way around by waving a certain kind of flagellum around, sort of whip-like structure. They spin it like a propeller. It's really quite cool. And the point Michael Behe makes is that it's not just like a propeller. It really is like it is a propeller. It's designed like a propeller you would find on a ship, and therefore it must have been designed. And he makes the argument that it's just too complicated. It's basically like a mousetrap. A mousetrap is a very simple device. If all of the pieces are not there in the mousetrap, it won't catch mice. It could not have evolved. And a funny thing is that somebody actually did show how you could have evolved a mousetrap from simpler and simpler devices. But anyway, I'm not going to spend a lot of time trying to explain how it is that all those things are wrong. But science has abundantly shown that these ideas are just incorrect. And yet, still, we keep being plagued by the problem that people keep trying to teach these ideas as science in schools. And back in 1998, I got the word. I was over in Austria at the time for some business for Scientific America, and I was watching a total eclipse of the sun, which is an extremely cool thing to do. And if you ever get a chance, you should certainly go do that. And while I was there, I suddenly heard that the school board of Kansas had determined that it was going to be teaching creationism insist that be taught as an equal scientific explanation in schools. So when I came home and I angrily wrote this editorial called "A Total Eclipse of Reason," doesn't show up very well there, but pretty much you can pretty much imagine the gist of this, in which I complained about this and I made the suggestion that maybe it would be really a wonderful thing if a school university administrators would just make a point of trying to send word back out to the people of Kansas that if their kids are not properly being trained in evolution, it makes them less qualified to be in their schools. I got some mail on that. People felt that was an unsound criticism. We'll get to just how unsound it is. But I will say that I am deeply, deeply disappointed. I am still deeply disappointed that is a suggestion that you cannot get administrators of universities to take. And a couple of years ago, I had dinner with a group of university presidents, and I sort of floated this idea to them. And I said, look, would you be willing to at least, you know, sort of sign some sort of petition, some sort of statement, something that people could point to that would indicate that, you know, really you would feel that people being trained, who are not being properly schooled in evolution, and that, and I would include teaching people that something like intelligent design is just as good an explanation as a form of science as evolution, that is not properly teaching them about evolution, that students being schooled in this way are just at a disadvantage in their eyes for admission to their universities, and nobody would agree to do it. It was actually amazing. They all had different sorts of explanations for it, and you know, I can be sympathetic, actually, to some of it. I know that there are lots of other issues, and an administrator's life is not an easy one. But it is really disappointing to see that it was not even an idea that was on the table as far as they were concerned. Nobody took it that seriously. A few years later, I happened to write this, which is, you can't see it too well, it's an article called 15 Answers to Creationist Nonsense. In which I just basically said, so let's just go through a bunch of the commonly raised questions or objections that people have about why it is that there must be something wrong with evolution or why intelligent design might be science. And I was trying to put this together. And let me just say, again, giving credit fully where it belongs, I was completely inspired by this, by something Michael Shermer had written a number of years before, in which he had, I can't even think of what it was called, but he used very much the same format. And I, you know, tried to give credit to Michael for this then, and actually showed him what I was doing, because I didn't want him or anybody else to think that I was just, you know, trying to crib his idea on that. But it was great. And this, it was really one of the things, it's probably the second most popular thing I've ever written. And even today, it's one of the articles that people still most go to on Scientific American's website. And I'm actually, you know, I'm very happy, very proud about the fact that they were able to try to do something like that. And I should probably update it. Let's move on to some other ideas. So far, I've looked at things like, you know, spiritualism and medical quackery and creationism, which are, in a sense, the sort of easy, obvious targets. You know, when we're skeptics, those are the kinds of things that leap right to mind all the time. But if you're going to be appropriately skeptical, and the way that Scientific American tries to be appropriately skeptical about things, it is good to also look at things skeptically when they do fall sort of more squarely in the area of just science itself. And cold fusion is one idea I think you pretty much are all familiar with. This was the suggestion. It started back in 1989 when two physicists at the University of Utah, Pons and Fleischmann, had issued a report that it seemed like that they were getting some sort of anomalous reaction in which they were getting more energy out of a combination of electrodes in solution than they should have. And they suggested that they were looking at some sort of fusion reaction that was taking place at room temperature instead of at the millions of degrees that physicists would normally say you would need to try to take two hydrogen nuclei and push them together and make helium and release lots of extra energy. And this idea, you know, certainly seized the world, got a lot of attention for a while, and unfortunately the claims for it did not hold up very well. When other scientists started to move in and try to reproduce it, they didn't have much luck. It turned out that it just wasn't reproducible. And so it fell off a lot, and Scientific American reported it in exactly that way, initially very interested, later, not so interested. Does not mean, however, that the world has completely lost interest, because in fact, even today, lo these many years since then, there are still plenty of people who are involved in cold fusion research. They are a marginal group, but they are an outspoken group. And they still refer to it as cold fusion, but they will often sometimes, this is a kind of setup that they will use, it's not actually an ice cube that's on fire, that was just me. Sometimes they'll have some sort of, you know, the solution of some sort with electrodes in it, and they'll still try to do this, and they, you know, present the different sorts of evidence that they have. They will oftentimes refer to it these days not so much as cold fusion, as something like either low-energy nuclear reactions or chemically-assisted nuclear reactions. And the problem is, the evidence for this still just isn't very good. It would be great if we could get cold fusion. It would be great if this really did represent some hitherto untapped energy resource, because heaven knows we need that. But, you know, although there have been a lot of studies that have been done, none of it gels very well. There may be something that is going on. It may be some sort of interesting chemical reaction, but it's probably not really a nuclear fusion reaction. And there's no clear evidence that you could use this as a great power source. At most, the readings always seem to be right at that kind of marginal level where the effects of calibration of your instruments and the sensitivity of your instruments seem to be right kicking in. So it's like, you know, this is the stuff that Michael Shermer refers to as borderland science. There may be something to it, but it's not well enough established to be able to do this. So we at Scientific American still don't take cold fusion very seriously. And we've, you know, we'll refer to it as having been sort of debunked, and, you know, we await this. And the people who are fans of this, fans of cold fusion, do not take this kindly. Not one bit. And what I would suggest, I mean, I happened to go back, in preparation for this talk, I happened to go back and download this. Again, it's, I don't know how many pages long it is, but really, if you want to have some fun, go later on, go home, Google my name and cold fusion, and not too many hits down there, you will see this thing. It says appeal to readers, coming from something like the, you know, LENR-CANR society, something like that. Look at this, because what they did was they released this set of correspondence that some of them had with me, in which they wanted to hold this up as an example of how unreasonable and unfair I've been, and how Scientific American needs to be browbeaten into recognizing the truth, man, about cold fusion. And it's just great. I mean, I had actually forgotten how this was, because I had started off, you know, they wrote to me a sort of polite letter in which they were saying, we really think it's very important for you to, you know, there's been so much evidence now. Thousands of researchers all around the world have collected tens of thousands of papers worth of interesting anomalous results, more than enough to indicate that there's clearly something quite real and deserving of further investigation. And in Japan, thousands of dollars have been spent on fusion research. And we really think the Navy did some recent investigations, and they thought that it wasn't entirely worth defunding the entire area. They wrote this to me, and I wrote a sort of, I thought, polite letter back, in which, I said, do I have it actually here? I mean, I don't want to bore you with the whole thing. Thank you for your email proposing that Scientific American reevaluate the status of LENR-CANR research and consider publishing an article on the subject. Unfortunately, I still don't see evidence in those papers or in the mainstream physics literature that it has achieved any significantly new level of credibility in the eyes of the general physics community. You know, it sort of basically says, if LENR-CANR can be demonstrated satisfactorily for acceptance by the physics mainstream, we would be more than happy to publish more favorable articles about it. Your problem starts with establishing more credibility in their eyes, not ours. Because this is the important thing. We're just a dopey magazine. Nobody actually, in the scientific world, nobody actually cares about what happens, you know, in actual serious science. It does not matter what Scientific American publishes. What matters is whether the journal Science and Nature and Physical Review Letters, if they're publishing papers about this, no, you got something. Well, they did not take that response well. And it just goes on and on with them writing back, getting more and more angry and, you know, insisting about various things. And I apparently just kept getting more and more snide all the way through this. Because it's just, I mean, I'm writing this stuff. It's like, wow, I was just having a blast writing this stuff. What's this? Here's one. And I have no problem with reading this because they put it up on the web and they want you to distribute this. So please download it and give it to your friends and family because you will have fun. I'm writing to Jed Rothwell about this. He says, Mr. Rothwell, I'm not sure how you think letters from my long gone predecessor will demonstrate how irrational I am, but you do what you feel is appropriate. Moreover, I noticed that although you called Jonathan Peel, my predecessor's decision, a catastrophic misjudgment almost a dozen years ago when he disregarded cold fusion research, the scientific mainstream would still side with him. Not bad as catastrophes go. Your message is full of fresh vitriol, but I'll repeat what I've said previously. It does you no good to curse Scientific American because the people you need to convince about the scientific credibility of cold fusion aren't journalists. They're professional physicists who review submissions for respectable technical journals. If you can convince mainstream scientists that LENR/CANR is real and significant, magazines like Scientific American will drop into line. Good luck! And he writes more, and he goes on and on about this, just attacking me. And then I'm coming back. And then we start to get into a big argument about whether Scientific American had been so blind that we hadn't believed that the Wright brothers had actually flown. And of course we believed that the Wright brothers had flown. We had an article about the Wright brothers having flown. We'd been running articles about early aviation for years before the Wright brothers, but they were treating it like we just dismissed flight out of hand. It's a lot of fun. It goes on there are a lot of things that I just write that are just more and more mean. And at some point I'm writing, so it really doesn't make a difference to me if LENR advocates petition me for articles on the subject. I'll put them on the stack of similar requests from the scientific creationists, the global warming deniers, the Face on Mars people, the crypto-archaeologists, and all the others who want publicity and scientific respectability but can't make their case convincingly to the community of scientists. But I'll say this again, too. If LENR/CANR's physicists can convince the mainstream physics community that they've got a credible case, Scientific American would be glad to write about it. And it's fun. Yeah, hours of entertainment right there. Nanotechnology. Nanotechnology, you say. How could I be skeptical about nanotechnology? We publish articles about nanotechnology. We've done single topic issues about nanotechnology. And in fact, nanotechnology is an extremely important, vigorous area of science and technology. There's a lot that's going on. By the year 2015, it will probably contribute about $1 trillion to the global economy. Nanotechnology is a big, growing area. Now, it should perhaps be noted that nanotechnology, some of us of a more cynical persuasion would say that it's actually slightly a great marketing term that applies to a lot of what used to be called applied materials research, certain forms of applied chemistry, certain kind of other, physics work. I'm not demeaning it in any way. I think it, in a lot of ways, was a great strategy to get attention for this very worthwhile work, to be able to come up with a name like nanotechnology and use that to get better funding for all of this. But it's just, let's get some perspective on what all of this is. Nanotechnology, the study of things that are extremely small, basically at the atomic molecular scale. The reason almost any of us have become to understand nanotechnology, the reason it's become a big thing, has become the work of this man, K. Eric Drexler, who's a perfectly good scientist, though known primarily as the advocate for nanotechnology in these areas. And he wrote this book, Engines of Creation, in which he predicted that nanotechnology was going to be so vigorous that we would achieve this ability to start to be able to eventually construct what he called nanoassemblers, sort of robots made at the atomic scale. And you can actually see, here's an example. He drew one on the left. He talked about this, and he painstakingly describes these, and they all sound like little claw machines on wheels or something, that they would actually just pick up one atom, and they'd put that atom down where it's supposed to be, and you'd be building things at the level of individual atoms. So that someday, as you can see in this other sort of more fanciful view of this, we would eventually have things like nanomedicine. nanomedicine, in which you would be able to release into our bodies these sorts of submicroscopic robots that could float around through our bodies and would be able to, you know, grab onto individual cells and repair them at the molecular level and rebuild our bodies this way. And you would make these, you know, more and more fanciful claims about that, you know, nanotechnology could be the key to actual immortality, because you would never die. And, you know, all the cryonicists who've made the argument that, you know, one of those big problems with cryonics, the idea that when you're frozen, and, you know, be frozen and then you'd be like, at some point you'd be resuscitated and made alive again. The two big objections that some of us have sometimes raised: one, you were dead and they have to make you alive again, which could be tricky, and that the freezing process that has at least often been used in the past is one that was highly disruptive of your cells, which you've seen if you've ever like thawed out meat. You see that it all leaks stuff. That's because the cells all broke open because of the ice crystals. Now, in fact, to be fair, modern cryonics, they use some different techniques that I'm told would not really do that. See previous comment about you do have to make them alive again. But never mind, that argument is that somehow nanotechnology is eventually going to, you know, bring us immortality, and that you would actually be able to release trillions of these sorts of nano-assembler robots onto a junk heap, and they would all work together to build you a new car, and that they could just, you know, is magical level of technology. It's really stupefying the kinds of predictions that they're making. And this is where we got skeptical. Because back in 19, you know, and also say that one of the other things they worry about is the cataclysmic arrangement in which these nano-assemblers run amok, and you create with what Drexler referred to as the gray goo scenario, in which you just basically get nano-assemblers that break loose and are just taking everything apart and making more nano-assemblers, so that pretty much the entire Earth is converted into a giant mass of nano-assembler. Not good for us, if it could actually happen. The reason we're skeptical about this is because actual nanotechnology is more at this kind of level of stuff. It's carbon structures. It's the sorts of it's very carefully made materials, and we're big believers in what nanotechnology can do. But back in 1996, we published an article in which we dared to suggest that some of the people who were big fans of nanotechnology and believed most fervently in Drexler's view of nanotechnology, that just maybe they were engaged in something that was more like the kind of science cargo cult in which they believed they were doing science, but they were actually just attaching every loose wish they possibly could to what this magical level of technology would eventually be able to do. Because the fact is that nanotechnology may be able to do wonderful things, and we may actually have these kinds of incredibly tiny machines that do our bidding in the future. But they're most likely not going to look, in fact, like little claw machines on carts. They're probably not going to look like little spiders that grab onto cells. They may look a lot like actual cells or modified proteins. We don't know where that's going. So it's kind of a ridiculous exercise in extrapolating the technology that far. It's really more at that point, it's just science fiction, not an exercise in real science. And we sort of called them on that, and they hated us to pieces for this. They hated us. And again, more homework, but I'm not going to try to get into all of this, but if you again, go home and Google my name and nanotechnology, and maybe Gary Stix or Scientific American. And a few hits down, you will get to something from the Foresight Institute, which is sort of a big nanotechnology operation. And you look for the debate that they put together, because they basically did exactly the same thing the cold fusion people did, where we went back and forth about the article and complained things, and they posted all of the information, and we complained about the fact that they took our entire article and put the whole thing online without, you know, sort of in violation of what we would think of as our copyright, which we're sort of sensitive about that kind of thing, since we sell the articles so I can buy them on things. Anyway, look at that. It's a lot of fun, because the great thing is that the you know, basically the argument never changes. We keep saying, look, It's too far out. We're not saying what you're saying is impossible. We're saying there's no actual good reason to believe that what you're saying is actually going to happen. And they keep saying, in effect, if you can't prove it's impossible, it must be true and you must take it seriously. And it doesn't matter that we can't demonstrate it. Nanotechnology is a theoretical technology. Theoretical technology. This is like applied theology, people. This is you got to think through where you're going with that. Anyway, look at that. That too is fun. But the great punchline on that is they think we've recanted our position. They look at the fact that we now publish issues on nanotechnology and they think we've quietly seen the light and changed our point of view on this. And by the way, you know, this is something we also mentioned in the original article. Even a lot of the people who are top leading nanotechnology scientists, when they, you know, they appreciate the fact that all what Drexler's people have done to get attention and funding for them, but when you sort of get them off to the side, a lot of them will actually acknowledge, yeah, those people are kind of crazy. That's not the stuff we're actually interested in doing. Real nanotechnology kind of going off in a different direction. Maybe if we ever get to the nanorobots, that's a long way out. We'll worry about that another time. You know, here's an interesting point. We can't do things with robots the size of a car now that they want to be able to do with invisibly tiny robots. So right there, there's an interesting point of just how far we are coming along with that. So I do these things, we publish these things, and I gotta tell you, we get mail. Mailbag. Now, it's mostly email rather than physical mail, and I just wanted to share with you some of the kind of mail that actually came in. And I just want to, you know, a few bright spots of that mail. Most of this goes to the creationist-related letters that I've gotten in, but it really, imagine this tone of thing comes through with all kinds of things that we publish. This was one of my favorites. The guy who wrote in, Cardinal Rennie, Your Highness. Read your recent defensive editorial about the fanatic attacks. Your straw man defense is preposterous, as is the idea that informational structure, life, can counter the second law of thermodynamics. Because apparently they think life is just, you know, that evolution somehow tries to avoid the second law of thermodynamics. It's great. So say, face reality and read William Dembski. That is actually a contradiction in terms. Here's another. John Rennie continues to show his unbridled arrogance and stupidity. Bingo. And he's from the editor's commentary in the February issue. If evolution is true, which everyone knows it is not, and we supposedly evolved from apes, chimps, and monkeys, how come apes, chimps, and monkeys are still around? See? It's that book. That there blows your ridiculous theory right out the window. Yeah, I love just the whole tone that that last thing says. Yeah, I was sitting on this porch when the boys were talking. Yeah, everyone was no idea that evolution's crazy stuff. Yeah. Then we got John Rennie is a fool and not very bright. The very fact that we exist is evidence of a supreme being that created all things, QED. People such as the person who approved this crap and John Rennie should be flogged, stoned, drawn and quartered, and spat upon. Oh, you had me at flogged. And I like this part. Scientists will not believe anything unless there is absolute proof. It's in the job description, man. And this... This of course, came out after that total eclipse of reason thing. Your condescending hyperbole continues with the suggestion that Kansas get rid of all intelligent education. I thought I was going the other way with that, but see. Finally, you end by applying mafia-like suggestions of extortion, by suggesting that when right the leadership in Kansas and warn them that if the children in Kansas did not get taught evolution, then they won't be able to keep up with the other children. You defend your approach by saying it's called survival of the fittest. Why not just cut to the chase with your convictions and send them all to the gas chamber? Well, it was good for him to read through my plea for a better education and see that as the genocidal impulse that it was. And this was one... I love this one because it's in two parts. What right does the current editor have to convert a scientific magazine editorial page into his views on religion or politics? I'm the editor. It's an editorial page. It's in the job description. But this was the good part. Keep your politically correct posturing to what appears to be your gay self. Bam! I did not see that coming. Not all of our correspondents actually turn out to be as much fun as those. You recognize this guy? He wrote to us. Sure, if you don't recognize him, you may know him a little better from that. Mr. Ted Kaczynski. Ted Kaczynski, in the, you may remember, for I think about 17 years, had the interesting hobby of he was blowing up various people who he saw as associated with the advance of technology and the spread of this. And it turns out he was a big reader of Scientific American. We know that. Well, we know that for several reasons. We know it sort of after the fact, after he was caught, because he would. It now became clear that although he lived in a hut way out of town, out in, where was this? Montana, he would walk the 5 miles from that hut into town and read Scientific American at the town library, because he was smart enough not to subscribe, because he thought that subscribing might make it too easy to track him down. We also know from, I gather, when the FBI, when they went over things inside the hut, not that there was a list of future people that he was going for, but there were certainly some sorts of things that the authorities thought might be indications of who he was sizing up as potential targets. And several of them were all people that Scientific American had been writing about, including, amazingly, one woman who just wrote sort of a humor piece for us back in those days. Astonishing. And we also know he read it because he decided to start writing to us for a little while. Back in, this would have been 96, I guess it was. No, this would have been 1995. What am I saying? It was 1995. I know it very clearly because that was the year that Scientific American, 1998, because we were celebrating our 150th anniversary. And we were, you know, Scientific American, kind of a big name when it comes to science and technology. And we were doing a well-publicized big single-topic issue called Key Technologies for the 21st Century. This was the equivalent of putting a great big bullseye on ourselves. And then he wrote a letter to us. We didn't know that he had written a letter to us. He had written this letter. In those days, he was writing to the New York Times and the Washington Post. The FBI was watching the correspondence with them. And one day, when he wrote to the Times, he included a copy of a letter that he had sent to us. And so the FBI came to Scientific American, went through our mail room at 4 o'clock in the morning, contacted the head of the company because they were looking for that letter. And the word came to me because they didn't find the letter, and they said, you know, you need to be on watch for this letter that may come in at any time, and we need to do this. You know, he didn't sign his letters of you know, Unabomber. He would just sign up with the letters FC. So, you know, you wouldn't necessarily recognize it. So I took a copy of that letter, and I gathered around my assistants and had them say, now look for this letter. Because, you know, this letter, you know, it wasn't making threats. He was just commenting on things he had read in the magazine. Actually, he seemed to read things in the magazine that he felt confirmed his ideas about how bad technology would be. Yay! And so we got this, and I showed it to the assistants who handled the mail, and said, so we have to watch for this. And one of them said, oh, I think that letter got here about 3 days ago. I put it in with all the other crazy mail. So that is the fact. The Unabomber's letter, not crazy enough to stand out from the other stuff that we got. But it's not a great thing. It's not a great thing to know that the Unabomber knows your address. And it put a lot of people on the magazine on edge for a long time. And, you know, we were watching all of the mail very carefully, and people had sort of standing orders, do not open packages that you are not comfortable with opening in any way. But that said, you know, it doesn't stop us from doing what we need to do. It doesn't stop us from publishing more important news about science and technology, and it certainly doesn't stop us from trying to attack the kinds of bad ideas about science and technology that also then start to proliferate out there. And but one day, we thought, just because, you know, this keeps going on all the time, we thought it would be fun to fun to just sort of have some fun with this. And this was actually probably the most popular thing that I ever published. Jen, can you? Is there a way to turn down the lamp on that a little bit? Or I don't know. There may not be a way to do it. Doesn't matter. This was a perspectives, an editorial piece that we published in which, for our April issue, and it was just called "Okay, We Give Up." And I thought that maybe I would just sort of end by trying to read this because it is really one of my the favorite things I've ever written. And the perspectives on this was this. Okay, we give up. There's no easy way to admit this. For years, helpful letter writers told us to stick to science. They pointed out that science and politics don't mix. They said we should be more balanced in our presentation of such issues as creationism, missile defense, and global warming. We resisted their advice and pretended not to be stung by the accusations that the magazine should be renamed Unscientific American, or Scientific Un-American, or even Unscientific Un-American. But spring is in the air, and all of nature is turning over a new leaf, so there's no better time to say, you were right, and we were wrong. In retrospect, this magazine's coverage of so-called evolution has been hideously one-sided. For decades, we published articles in every issue that endorsed the ideas of Charles Darwin and his cronies. True, the theory of common descent through natural selection has been called the unifying concept for all of biology and one of the greatest scientific ideas of all time, but that was no excuse to be fanatics about it. Where were the answering articles presenting the powerful case for scientific creationism? Why were we so unwilling to suggest that dinosaurs lived 6,000 years ago, or that a cataclysmic flood carved the Grand Canyon? Blame the scientists. They dazzled us with their fancy fossils, their radiocarbon dating, and their tens of thousands of peer-reviewed journal articles. As editors, we had no business being persuaded by mountains of evidence. Moreover, we shamefully mistrusted the intelligent design theorists by lumping them in with creationists. Creationists believe that God designed all life, and that's a somewhat religious idea. But ID theorists think that at unspecified times, some unnamed super powerful entity designed life, or maybe just some species, or maybe some of the stuff in cells. That's what makes ID a superior scientific theory. It doesn't get bogged down in details. Good journalism values balance above all else. We owe it to our readers to present everybody's ideas equally, and not to ignore or discredit theories simply because they lack scientifically credible arguments or facts. Nor should we succumb to the easy mistake of thinking that scientists understand their fields better than, say, U.S. senators or best-selling novelists do. Indeed, if politicians or special interest groups say things that seem untrue or misleading, our duty as journalists is to quote them without comment or contradiction. To do otherwise would be elitist, and therefore wrong. In that spirit, we will end the practice of expressing our own views in this space. An editorial page is no place for opinions. Get ready for a new Scientific American. No more discussions of how science should inform policy. If the government commits blindly to building an anti-ICBM defense system that can't work as promised, that will waste tens of billions of taxpayers' dollars and imperil national security. You won't hear about it from us. If studies suggest that the administration's anti-pollution measures would actually increase the dangerous particulates that people breathe during the next 2 decades, that's not our concern. No more discussions of how policies affect science, either. So what if the budget for the National Science Foundation is slashed? This magazine will be dedicated purely to science, fair and balanced science, and not just the science that scientists say is science. And it will start on April Fool's Day. Thank you.